1 John chapter 4. We're going to camp out this morning as we look at our fourth objection. We're still going through our series, Six Reasons Christianity Can't Be True. We come to the fourth reason it can't possibly be true, which is that there can't be just one way. All right, can't be just one way to God. With so many sincere, devoted people from other religions, it would be at best arrogant to assume that any one religion has all the truth, right? In fact, we'll look at arrogance in much more detail next week. That's pretty much the whole of our focus next week. But take it a step further, not just arrogant to assume that one religion has all the truth, but it has historically led to all sorts of conflict in the world, right? I mean, massive religious conflict. You look back through history and you can see how long this has been going on, right? And I don't need to make this point because we all are aware of it already. It doesn't take long to see this, right? I mean, you can go back as far as the Crusades, if you like, right? This kind of black mark on Christianity's history. You've got a much more recent conflict in the Balkans, Northern Ireland, what's going on in Palestine, and been going on there for a while, right? 9/11, right? Driven by religious conflict. What's happening with ISIS even now? You see what the problem is, right? I mean, this sort of fundamentalist belief just leads to conflict. So what do we need to do? We need to temper belief, right? And get people to hold their beliefs just a little more loosely. And it would help us out, could bring peace. This objection, if I could sum it up in bumper sticker form, which is always nice, it's the bumper sticker that you see all around, right, that says coexist, right? Coexist, and it's got the letters are spelled out with familiar iconography from the different world religions, right? The T is Christianity's cross, for example. And so that's what we need to do. So what's our solution? How are we going to get past all the religious conflict in the world? We got two options, I suppose. One would be to just get rid of religion altogether. And certainly plenty would advocate for that. And we've seen people in history try to do just that. Soviet Empire certainly tried to. Even in China today, this is a similar approach. Get rid of religion, or at the very least, let's get rid of fundamentalism, right? Get rid of the fanaticism that attaches itself to so many of the world religions. If we could get past the exclusivity of the different religions and embraced instead religious pluralism, the idea that all religions have truth to offer, well, that might help us out as well. That's the objection in a nutshell. So what we're going to do this morning is we look at 1 John 4:1-12. Here's my outline, okay? I'm going to go through why getting rid of religion won't work to bring peace. I'm going to look at why embracing pluralism won't work to bring peace. And then, most radical of all, I'm going to suggest that Christianity actually will work to bring this sort of peace if it's true gospel Christianity. So, bold outline. Let's dig in here. I'm going to go ahead and read 1 John 4:1-12, and then we'll get started. John writes, "Dear friends, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. This is how you can recognize the Spirit of God. Every spirit that acknowledges that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God, but every spirit that does not acknowledge Jesus is not from God. This is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard is coming, and even now is already in the world. You, dear children, are from God and have overcome them, because the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world. They are from the world and therefore speak from the viewpoint of the world, and the world listens to them. We are from God, and whoever knows God listens to us, but whoever is not from God does not listen to us. This is how we recognize the spirit of truth and the spirit of falsehood. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us and his love is made complete in us. All right, there's your text. Now, as has been in the case in this series, of course, I'm not going through the text point by point, right? We're drawing out some of the implications of the text as we look at the topic each week. So here especially, the first part of this, why getting rid of religion won't work, just a hint of why it won't work here in the text. But there is a hint. All right, and it's there in verse 1. Do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. Now, that's an interesting statement, right? Because John is very definitely concerned about false teachers, right? False prophets, people who are presenting a false message. So why doesn't he say, test the teachers, test the prophets, test their teaching? Why does he say, test the spirits instead? And commentators agree that what John's getting at is that there is a range of real spiritual influences behind the teaching. Okay, there are spirits that animate the different teaching that we have. And so the question needs to be asked, what sort of teaching, or what sort of spirit is it that's animating this particular teaching? And this is where we get this hint, this deep truth that's so important for our topic this morning. And it's this, that there is a religious impulse within all of us, right? There is a spiritual influence of some sort within all of us. We were made to worship, and so we will worship something. All right, now it could be all sorts of different things. It could be different gods, right? It could be Jesus, could be Allah, could be Brahman, you know, something like that. Or it could be something else altogether, right? There are plenty of gods within secularism, atheism as well. It could be money, could be sex, could be power, right? But we're going to worship something because there is this spiritual influence in our life. There's this religious impulse in all of us. We all devote ourselves to whatever it is that we think will bring our lives ultimate meaning, whether it's got a God's name attached to it or not. And you can see this. So last week we looked at science, right? And the objection of atheistic naturalism. You read these atheist writers talk about science, and they talk about it, talk about nature in rapturous terms. I mean, just worshipful terms. There's no way around it. In fact, they capitalize the N in nature all the time, which is interesting, right? And where are they getting that from? But that's the idea, right? We have to worship something. We're made to worship something. And so that religious impulse just comes out even if we deny its existence. Because we're made to worship, we will worship something. And John's just saying, so be really careful about what it is you worship. Test it. Make sure it's something that's actually worth worshiping. Because, of course, a lot of the gods are not going to satisfy, right? I mean, money very clearly doesn't do this. Not a good god to devote your life to. Statistically, too, we can just see that this whole idea of getting rid of religion, just not going to work. People have been talking about the death of religion for at least two centuries. With everything that we were learning about, especially with science, the Enlightenment, rationalism, you know, religious faith was supposed to be on the decline, and it's just not happening. Every major religion is growing. I know the stats on Christianity best because that's my faith, right? And so, you know, you look at a country like Korea, in the last 100 years has gone from about 1% to about 40%. Continent of Africa as a whole has gone from about 9% to almost 50%. And even in those places where they're trying to stamp out religion, and especially a Western religion like Christianity, we see it just exploding, right? Like in China, the whole revolution there, and they expelled all of the foreigners, and that was it. That was supposed to be the death knell for Christianity in China. Instead, it strengthened the church there because it meant that the church had become indigenous. nationalized leaders, right? And so estimates that are in China right now is that the house churches there are between 50 and 500 million people. And so, yeah, not going to work, all right? Just not going to happen, not going to be able to stamp out religion. So let's move on, because that's a fool's errand, okay? So let's look at the next one. If you can't get rid of religion, again, let's at least get rid of fanaticism, exclusivity. Let's embrace pluralism instead. Let's look at why that won't work. Again, just a hint here, but a hint from verse 5. Verse 5 says, "They are from the world, and therefore speak from the viewpoint of the world, and the world listens to them." Now this, they, whoever it is we're talking about, is a group of critics of Christianity, right? Okay, so the critics of Christianity, John says, are still speaking from a viewpoint. Okay, they're coming from a point of view already, a worldview, a religious framework, if you will, which is already in place, which means that they are coming from a faith position in order to criticize faith. All right, and that's not going to work so well. But again, what's John pointing out here that's so important for us to understand is that all of us depend on a worldview. We have a set of religious assumptions in our minds already. Those religious assumptions may be decidedly anti-religion, but they are still religious assumptions. They are still thoughts about God and religion that are strongly in place already. And one of the problems, of course, is that oftentimes these religious assumptions, well, they're assumptions, right? They're not proven. They're not tested. They're left critically unexamined, which is what's so dangerous. And of course, the problem, you know, they speak from the point of the view of the world, and the world listens to them. Again, tendency we all have, right, in our nature. We like to listen to people who already agree with us. I'll just give you this, you know, prove this point very easily by looking at politics, right? We're in election season. We got very different points of view going on in the country today. And what do? We tune into the radio heads, you know, that tell us what we already agree with. We read the blogs of the people we already agree with. Make sure we're reading the newspaper articles, the editorialists that we already agree with. Because then as we're listening, we're going, uh-huh, see, yeah, I knew it. Exactly. That's what I thought already, and it's just being reinforced because it's the only stuff I'm listening to. And this is what we do with religion as well. So, again, the fundamental irony coming from this unexamined faith position, this unexamined religious assumption in order to criticize faith. And what I want to do here is tease out why this won't work when it comes to pluralism in particular, okay? So what are some of the central tenets of pluralism, these religious assumptions that we kind of just like to say and again, leave unexamined? Two of them in particular. You've heard them a bunch. Okay? Lots and lots of times, I'm sure. First, all religions are equally valid. Okay? All religions are equally valid. And then second, private religious experience is fantastic. We're so happy for you that you're enjoying that. Don't you dare bring it into the public sphere. Okay? It's got no place in public discourse. All right, so those are the two major assumptions of religious pluralism. All religions equally valid, private religious experience is fantastic, but it's got no place in public. Leave it in the home. Let's examine each of these to see if they actually work. Start with the first one. I'll spend more time here. All religions are equally valid. Hear this plenty, right? You know, just first thing we got to say is just that's naked assertion. Okay? This is a faith statement that is being made without a shred of evidence given in support of it. All right, so just got to start there and go, let's challenge this assumption. Let's at least question it at the outset. Worth questioning, too, because it is patently false. Okay, cannot possibly be true. It's a statement that basically undoes itself. Say all religions are equally true. That can't be true if the religions contradict each other. And the religions definitely contradict each other in a lot of different areas, right? We're also dealing not with what philosophers call contraries, but with contradictories, much stronger. Contraries is you got two statements that both can't be true simultaneously, but it's also possible that just another statement is true instead. And I'll give you an example here. So the statement, Brandon Cooper is the greatest pastor in the world. Okay, statement number one. Thank you. Great. Well, but number two is going to make it trickier, though. Kyle Bierga is the greatest pastor in the world. Audience says. All right. Now, one or the other of those statements can be true. They can't both be true. But far more likely that neither of them are true, right? Okay? Can we say that? Yeah. Amen. I got an amen. All right. Those are contraries. We're not dealing with contraries. We're dealing with contradictory statements where either one or the other has to be true in this case. And so flatly contradictory. Pluralism would affirm, you could read pluralist writers, they'll tell you this, the ultimate is personal, because that's what, Islam, Christianity, Judaism teach. And at the same time, the ultimate, capital U, is not personal. They cannot go together, right? I could point out, many, many other examples of this. So patently false, because the religions contradict each other, they can't all be equally valid, equally true. In addition, for a group of people that are preaching tolerance very strongly, right, inclusivity, this is so incredibly insulting to every religious tradition. Because you talk to an Orthodox adherent of any world religion and you tell them that at their core they believe exactly what everybody else believes, that's just insulting. It's nonsense and it's insulting. All right? So we got to see that. I'm going to tease that out some, because this is really the fundamental flaw with pluralism, which is the privileging of its own faith system. Okay, so to criticize faith from the perspective of faith system, you're saying don't privilege faith systems right as you privilege your own. Here it is. Let me make this point clearly. So John Hick, who is the world's preeminent pluralist, okay, certainly the most learned and persuasive pluralist scholar around today, argues along these lines. Once you learn that there are other intelligent, sincere, good people in the world who hold beliefs different than your own, well, it's just absolutely arrogant to continue to evangelize, try to convert, or to hold your view as in any way higher or superior to theirs. Okay, so that's the heart of pluralism right there. But here's the problem, right? Here's the fundamental flaw with all of this. Most people in the world don't agree with Hick. Most people in the world from the different world religions disagree completely. Presumably, at least a handful of them are intelligent, sincere, good people, then, who clearly disagree with Hick. So why is he still trying to convince us, then? Isn't it arrogant of him to try and convince us, to effectively evangelize us towards pluralism? Isn't it arrogant, wrong to hold his view as in any way superior to ours? This is the fundamental flaw. To insist that all people believe pluralism is still arrogant, right? Every bit as exclusive and narrow-minded as any Orthodox religion, right? You're still saying, I'm right, I know what I'm talking about, but it's got the benefit of being hypocritical as well as arrogant. Because you're saying, I'm right in saying that you're wrong to say that you're right. Right, this is an issue here. Let me illustrate this by turning to a very famous parable that's often used to defend pluralism. And look, this parable, you've probably heard it before. It's got tremendous emotional appeal, but unfortunately suffers from the same fundamental flaw. So here's the parable. Again, you probably heard it, I'm hoping so I don't have to say the whole thing. But you got these six blind guys who are out walking, right? And apparently, probably quite literally, stumble into an elephant that they've never encountered before. They have no idea what an elephant is. And each one of them has stumbled into a different part of the elephant. So you got one guy who's holding the trunk, right? And he's going, okay, so it's kind of like a hose or something, right? Another guy's got the tusk, and so he's going, no, elephant's much more like a spear. Another guy's got the ear, and so he's going, no, it's much more like a fan, and so on and so forth, right? And again, here's the point of this little parable. The elephant is obviously whatever this ultimate reality is that's beyond every world religion. And these six blind guys are, again, breathtaking condescension, adherents of the major world religions, right? And so they all have got a portion of the truth, I guess, but are just off track because they've taken a piece of it and made it the whole thing. Again, tremendous emotional appeal, right? Like you're listening to this parable going, yeah, that kind of makes sense to me, actually. Here's the problem with the parable, though. How do you know it's an elephant? There's only one way to know that it's an elephant in the first place. If you, the really sophisticated, enlightened person who's sharing the parable, can see. So you're the only one who has the privileged position of sight. I know what the elephant looks like. The rest of you are morons. That's what that parable's really teaching. This is the fundamental flaw with religious pluralism. This deep-seated arrogance being disguised as radical inclusivity. Okay, so issues here for sure. If it's narrow and wrong to say that there's one true religion, then it's narrow and wrong to say that there's one true way to think about religion that is every bit as exclusive as Christianity or any other world religion. There are other issues here as well, even on this first point of all religions are equally valid. One of the issues is that no one actually wants to say all religions are equally valid. Because there are certain religions, cults, right, where we want to go, no, that's not valid at all. No one wants to say the Branch Davidians were a legit experience of this ultimate reality, right? You got some cult that the heart of it is ritualistic child abuse. We want to go, no, that's wrong. That's not a fair expression of religion. But now we're kind of heading into point two about keeping it to yourself. This will move us in that direction. How do you determine that? Why do you get to say, well, clearly that's not real religion, but these 8 to 12 or whatever are? What is the standard that you're using? Because the whole problem, of course, is that we've undone the standard by which we could judge. Pluralism, of course, comes out of Western Enlightenment thinking. And the heart of this comes from Immanuel Kant. We've got him to thank for this. It is this what's called the fact-value distinction. There are facts. They come up in science, mathematics primarily. Okay, those sorts of areas. Objective facts that everybody can agree on. And then there are values. Values are things like, you know, this is the greatest band in the world, where you go, really? You know, we could probably disagree about this. Or values are things like moral judgments. All right, now those are entirely subjective, right? Can't establish those on the basis of these agreed upon facts. There's no mathematical theorem that's going to lead you in this direction. So again, now we are left without any standard whatsoever. So let's, with that in mind, this whole breakdown of the fact-value distinction, Enlightenment's greatest gift to us, what does that do now to this second point? Your private religious experience is great, but keep it to yourself. It's meant to be private. Don't bring it into the public realm. We got a big issue here because John Somerville argues a religion can be judged only on the basis of another religion. Makes this point in his book, The Decline of the Secular University, which is in your recommended reading there. And what he's trying to say there is apparently these value claims can only be judged on the basis of other value claims. So we can have absolutely no discussion about values without bringing in, again, a whole chunk of religious assumptions. So this whole idea that religion is private, don't bring it in the public sphere, won't work. It would be absolutely impossible to do this. Let me make this point. We could take a whole lot of hot-button issues, right? Abortion, same-sex marriage, these sorts of things. A lot of emotion coming up there, though. So I'm going to take some other ones. Plenty of emotion still, but we'll take just slightly less warm discussions. Here's one. So again, we're in primary season, and you know, one of the major divides between the left and the right is income inequality, right? So now, how do you determine that it is a good and fair thing to do to redistribute wealth so that there is at least a degree of parity, right? Some income equality at least. That does not come from science or mathematics or any sort of objective statement like that, right? This is a purely a value statement. Okay, there's a level of wealth above which no people should be allowed to live. That money should be dispersed to the poor instead. That's a value statement. Or to say no, to do that would be tantamount to theft, really, right? I mean, free market, private property, all that kind of stuff. How could you have, again, one of the major policy discussions going on in the country today without bringing in what are value statements, unfortunately, religious discussions? Or take another one. One that our country has settled, unfortunately, in the wrong direction, which would be divorce laws. So 50 states all have no-fault divorce laws. Where did that come from? Where did the discussion go? Well, we live in a highly individualistic society. I've said before that the heart of American society is expressive individualism, to use Robert Bellah's phrase. Enshrined in Supreme Court decisions, even, right? The heart of freedom, one justice argued, was every person's right to freedom of expression, to determine how they will find their own happiness. So this is the highest law of the land for us, and certainly is true culturally. Which means that when we come into a marriage where you got two people who are not getting along anymore, as rugged individualists, we go, okay, look, if this is not bringing you the happiness that you thought it should, if you're not free to express your individuality like you would, then you should be free to terminate this marriage. And again, that's our laws here. But now, you were to look at a very different society, not a highly individualistic society, but a traditional society, we would be in a very different place. Because there, the individual doesn't have, primacy. But instead, the individual is seen as a key part of a larger communal structure, especially the extended family. And so now, all of a sudden, the decision might be, well, look, y'all might not get along that well, but tough. Okay, you've got parents, generations before you to honor, and kids that you need to stay together for. And so we're at an impasse, right? Well, how do you determine which one of those viewpoints is correct? It's going to be a purely religious discussion, right? In the sense of it's a values discussion. There's nothing objective or fact-based about this. This is the problem that we have. Look, that's an important point, and I'm just barely beginning to tease it out. If you want more on this, the books by Somerville, McIntyre, and Smith in the back, your recommended reading, especially The Disenchantment of Secular Discourse. Fantastic book. Dig in. He makes this point in a number of ways. But let's, for the sake of time, move on to point three. So getting rid of religion, just not going to work. Unfortunately, embracing pluralism doesn't work either, unless you're willing to embrace all sorts of inconsistencies. But what I want to propose, again, most radically of all, is that Christianity will actually give us a way forward, an end to religious conflict. The answers to two of the most important questions about salvation get at the distinctives of Christianity and why it actually can work. The uniqueness of the gospel can put an end to religious conflict. And so the two questions are why, right? Why is Jesus trying to save us? What's the goal of salvation? And then how? How does Jesus save us? That would be the method of salvation. Those are the two questions. Now, before we get to that, everybody loves verse 7, right? Verse 7, like this is the heart of our culture right here. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. And then verse 8, God is love. And again, resonates deeply with us. We're all going, exactly, right? Let's just love each other. Again, that's the common core of every religion. Let's just talk about love. Let's move towards more love in the world. It's, what the world needs now, the one thing that there's just too little of. Okay, so that's where we are. But again, the problem is if we don't test the spirit, if we don't test the religious impulse, the religious assumptions behind this, our religion may well lead not to love, but actually to hate. And that could be true even of an anti-religion, secularism, atheism, something like that. And we'll see how this works. So, all right, here are again the two questions. Why is Jesus saving us? What's the goal of salvation? Look at verse 2. This is how you can recognize the Spirit of God. Every spirit that acknowledges that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God. Well, that's a radical statement, okay? Certainly unique to Christianity. When it says Jesus Christ has come, right there we got a big difference, right? Because now we have a religion whose founder is not just a particularly enlightened human who is showing us how to live for God, but instead we actually have God himself come in the flesh, right? In order to bring us back to God, right? I mean, so totally unique right there. But let's focus in on the flesh piece to really answer this question. Why? Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. Radical statement. Radical statement. Here's why. In other views, flesh is evil, right? Flesh is what you want to get past. That's kind of the goal of religion. So in most Eastern religions, for example, when you reach the end goal, you become pure spirit, right? Flesh is altogether gone. Or in most Western religions, at the very least, what you're trying to do is beat down the flesh, right? Win the battle against the flesh, something like that. And so you've got, things like your five pillars, your Ten Commandments, or something like that, ways to keep the flesh in subjection. But Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. What does that say about God's view of the physical world, the physical body? I mean, the incarnation, Christ coming in the flesh, is God's yes to the physical world. And if that's true, I think that's Bonhoeffer's phrase, then the resurrection has got to be the exclamation point after the yes. God is very pro-physical world, physical body. Christ was raised in the flesh, in a physical body, which means the end goal is physical, right? God's not wiping out earth to transport us all to some super spiritual heaven. God is going to remake the earth, physical earth. And this is where we'll live. The heavens and earth will come together. God's not trying to help us escape the world. God is actively working to redeem the world. Now, what does that do then to our lives here? Look, if the end goal is getting past this world, right? Escaping from the world, getting past flesh, then your goal will be just to convert other people. That's all you need them to do, is just to agree with you. You're going to be doing kind of this like lifeboat evangelism, right? The ship is sinking, you just need to get off it. And all that matters is that you're in a lifeboat, doesn't really matter what happens there. But if you think that God is going to remake this world, well, this is going to alter the way you interact with the world, right? If we know that the end goal is that on this earth there will be perfect justice, well, we may begin to work for that justice even now, working to transform the world even now. We'll become exactly the sorts of Christians that God has commanded us to be. Take a passage like Jeremiah 29:3. God's speaking to the Israelites who are in exile in Babylon. Okay, their enemies disagree with them pretty strongly, especially when it comes to religion, right? What does God say to these Israelites living in Babylon? Jeremiah 29:3, seek the peace of the city where you live. I mean, this is, again, kind of a counterintuitive statement. If your whole goal is to get out of Babylon, go back to Israel, why would you be working for the prosperity of the town where you are? Especially if, again, these are people who disagree with you religiously. And yet, well, this is the whole idea, right? We can be agents of transformation, agents of justice and peace even in this world. Again, it's a passage like this is one of the reasons why we chose City View as the name of our church. We want to be these sorts of Christians. It's why we would take time on a Sunday to pray for victims of child abuse. Right, because our hope isn't, well, these people just, they just need Jesus. Let's just try and get these kids converted. They can have their pie in the sky when they die. Like, that's not it at all. But to say, yeah, they need Jesus. We all need Jesus. But they also need justice. They need a home where they can grow up free from abuse. And so we partner with these sorts of ministries. So that's the why, the goal of salvation, radically distinctive, might actually lead to some peace. But especially the how, the method of salvation. This is where we'll see Christianity could actually work in particular. As I mentioned, we all love verse 7, but verse 7 leads into verse 10, right? 9 and 10. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Do you hear what was just said there? You didn't love God. I didn't love God. Right? So God had to love us. He had to initiate this whole thing. He had to initiate salvation. Salvation is not based on what we do, because none of us love God as we should. So he had to love us first. Romans 5:8, right? God demonstrated his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So the how of salvation is, of course, grace, not our performance, not based on anything we've done, but based entirely on what he has done for us. Think about what that knowledge will do to your sense of religious superiority. That's going to mess with it, right? I'm here because of him, because of what he has done, not what I have done. It's going to be really tricky to look down on somebody that I think isn't performing up to standards when my whole identity is based on the fact that I didn't perform up to standards. Somebody else had to perform them for me. We typically, in our nature, feel disdainful of those who are not following what we think is the true path. And again, this is true religion or anti-religion, irreligion, right? So you get the religious people who are keeping the Ten Commandments or the Eightfold Path or the Five Pillars, something like that, right? And it's got a number in it so you can check off and make sure you did them all. That's how we know. You're looking at the people who aren't checking off those numbers and you're going, immoral, right? In contrast to me. Now over here, we've got our secularists, our atheists and whatnot, who are looking over at the people who are checking off the numbers and going, bigots. You see how in both cases, you're not following what you think enlightenment is, and how do you feel about the people around you? You're able to look down your nose at them. But not so with the gospel. It just doesn't work with the gospel. And here's why. The advent of postmodernism, thinkers have begun to understand that we define ourselves by excluding others. Okay, we define ourselves by excluding others. We want to draw little concentric circles around ourselves so that we know I'm this and they're not this. I'm a Cubs fan, which means automatically circle drawn around me. Gotta hate the Yankees. I think it's just right anyway. Gotta hate the Cardinals. Gotta hate the Brewers. Gotta hate the Sox, whatever it is, right? So, okay, I've got this little distinction drawn around me. We could take it to a much deeper level than that really quickly, right? Political parties, beliefs, whatever. We bolster our self-esteem by devaluing others. Other races, other political parties, other religious beliefs, other personality traits, whatever it may be. But Christians, if they've been touched by the gospel, define themselves not by excluding others, but by identifying with the one who was excluded for them, with Christ. Excluded for our sake, crucified outside the city gate, right? Kicked out of Jerusalem, excluded from humanity, and forsaken by God, excluded by God, right? This is where the heart of our identity comes from, which, as I've said before, does some things to us, right? It humbles us more deeply than any other religion can, because it's saying, you cannot do this. You will never perform up to standards. I'm much more sinful than I ever dared imagine. But it also affirms us more powerfully than any other religion can. Why? Because I'm much more deeply loved than I ever dared hope. What does this mean? That now I can't despise anyone anymore just because they're different. Because God should have despised me, but he didn't. He despised his son in my place. Which, in this wonderful fit of irony, then means, I think this is right, that Christianity is the only religion where you would expect that people from other religious backgrounds are more moral. You're going to find a lot of people, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, whatever, who are doing way better at living up to snuff than I am. And Christianity would lead us to expect that. But look at how that viewpoint could transform religious conflict, all these battles that are going on. So back to John Hick, again, the preeminent pluralist in the world today. And he recognizes that you don't actually want to say all religions are equally valid. And so this was his standard. He said, a religion is valid if it moves people from self-centeredness to what he calls reality-centeredness. Reality with a capital R, again, whatever that ultimate is. So it's got to move you from self-centeredness to reality-centeredness. Will religion move us away from self-centeredness? If religion is performance-based, could it possibly move us away from an orientation around the self? I don't think so, right? In religion, again, if you're checking off, I did the 10 or I did the 5 or I did the 8, whatever it is, I'm obeying divine standards out of fear and self-interest, right? I don't want bad karma. I don't want to face wrath. I want heaven. I want whatever prosperity I'm promised in this life. In other words, religion, if it's performance-based, religion will actually reinforce the selfishness that's inherent in our hearts already. It's going to make us worse, not better, which is why we see so much religious conflict. And this is why the method of salvation is so important. That's what religion does. But with grace, what's the motivation? Fear and self-interest? No, that's taken care of. That got taken care of on the cross. The motivation is gratitude and love to please and imitate the one who gave his life for us. Now that will do away with self-interest pretty quickly, which is why we read verses 11 and 12. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. Not so that God will love you, so that you can experience acceptance, divine acceptance. No, because you already have it. Because you got it long before you deserved it. Because that's true. We ought to love one another. That flows right out of that. Which leads into verse 12. No one has ever seen God, but they could see the reality of God in our lives if we were loving one another with a gospel sort of love. Let me conclude by sharing a story with you. I just happened to read this week and thought this is good. I'm including this. So D.A. Carson tells the story. One of my professors in seminary, it was back when he was a student at McGill University in Canada. And he was a chemistry student, and he and another guy had led an evangelistic Bible study for, you know, some of their classmates. And so, naturally enough, you know, these six reasons were coming up plenty often, right? And the religious pluralism one came up. And Carson was feeling a little uncertain about how to answer all the questions, which is a great hope to me because he's the single brightest individual I know. And so if he had trouble with these questions, I'm feeling good. Okay, that helps me out, right? So he took some of these people to the bold evangelist on campus, you know, the guy, right? And so, yeah, took him to see that guy. And the guy said, all right, you know, what's the issue? Lay it on me kind of thing. And this person who came from a liberal Christian background kind of just said everything I've said this morning, right? I mean, what gives you the right to think that you know better than everybody else? There's got to be truth in these other places. What makes you think you're different? And this bold evangelist, Dave was his name, looked at the guy for a moment, and said, "Watch me," which caught the guy off guard. Not the answer he was expecting, right? Not at all. Bit of a non sequitur almost. He said, "No, watch me." He said, come live with me. Move in, okay, for the semester. I'll pay for your room and board. That's no big deal. You know, you got to go to class, you got to go to class, that's fine. Do what you need to do. But otherwise, you watch me. He says, you watch me when I get up, when I interact with people, what I say, what moves me, what I live for, what I want in life. You watch me for the rest of the semester, and then you tell me at the end of it whether or not there's a difference. Bold, right? Like I said, this was the bold evangelist on campus. Not sure I'm doing this. There's a challenge here, though. There's a challenge here for everyone in the room, both groups. Those of us who claim to be Christians, the challenge is this. Could we say that? Somebody comes to us and says, "I don't see what the difference is between all the world religions." Could you look them in the eye and go, "Watch me. You'll see the difference because I'm motivated by the gospel, not by my performance." And see that difference. That's the challenge for us. If you're here this morning, and you're a skeptic, though, right? If you're here this morning because you're going, "Yes, exactly, everything you just said, that's the problem with Christianity." My challenge to you is, watch us. Watch us. See if you can spot the difference. Let's pray. Lord, I'm not sure any of us really wanted to utter those last two words. Watch us. Because we know how often we fall short of your glory. Of how many times each day we are still motivated by a deep-seated self-centeredness. But Lord, we also trust in the power of the gospel to remake us in your image, to conform us to the image of your Son. And so we trust, Lord, that you are working in us, that there is a difference, that the gospel will lead us to a type of love that the world will not find anywhere else. May this be increasingly true of us as a congregation. And Lord, I pray for those who are here this morning who are skeptics, who are asking these sorts of questions. And as imperfect as we are, Lord, may they see the truth of the gospel in the way we love each other, the way we love them, the way we love the city, the way we love the world. We ask this for the sake of your name, Lord. Amen.